So first text, Mackenzie Work. Hacker Manifesto. So the text has been around for a long time. And it's been very broadly read, I would say.
It's
somehow a text that grasps the from a specific perspective what would be the culture of hacking.
And yeah, as a background, I mean, you can see it through the text, but Mackenzie Work is really has a background in Marxism, and he worked on the Situationist International, and he's a critical theorist, I guess. But so, and that you see in style, but you see also in a bit the general frame of the Hacker Manifesto. It's basically trying to do, it's quite at the same time a joke, but an arrogant joke, anyways, of a communist manifesto for somehow the next level of abstraction, if you think capitalism as an abstraction from the material conditions, and somehow the information flow as another level that changes how capitalism works. So he tries to sketch this hacker class as a new revolutionary class that he calls for agitation. So in a way, it's but some things, for example, this vector concept, they're quite interesting because they deal with the specificity of information flows. So it's
reading it now again, you see that some of the concepts are really interesting and useful. It's more the positioning of the manifesto, the calling out the hacker class as a kind of exceptional agents that would be able to understand and respond to this situation. I think that's the biggest problem.
So from which year is it? Just a question.
I think the first sketches were either end of 90s or 2000, and the book I think is 2004. But I mean, they didn't just say random dates.
Okay.
So we'll read 1 hour in this, and then we'll have another hour with a text that is quite differently written. As you see, it's 31 to 39. So we should be able to do it in an hour. So it's written by Cory Doctorow, someone deeply embedded in the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And it's a text that comes out of the rage of this battle between the standard and the digital rights management being implemented. And it helps to understand the consequences of these kind of shifts. And I think what is interesting is that you also can really sense the anger and the frustration and the sort of frustrated utopia that Cory Doctorow has. You're a reader of Doctorow, no?
Yes.
Yeah. Maybe you can say something about it.
Oh, well, Cory Doctorow is a novelist, so he's mainly writing, novels for growing. It's not teenage novels, but for young people with an agenda to help understand the politics behind technology. And the novels are great. I mean, I'm a big fan. But this is a really atypical thing. He's an activist for electronic culture, and then his work is writing novels. So one beautiful one, which is connecting to all of you, all of what's been saying, is called Pirate Cinema. Cinema.
Yeah.
And the Pirate Cinema explains by a very simple story of a boy who gets trapped in hacker circles and is really an enthusiastic filmmaker. But in the background, it explains all the logics of industrial control over creative production. And so it's an adventure story. If you have nothing to read, then I would download it from his website, which is craphound.org, and it's all available under free licenses, and you're encouraged to remix it and upload it to the same platform.
So an author that experiments with releasing his novels under free licenses, so the novels are available in print, but also you can download them without restrictions or without having to ask for permission. And so it's trying to demonstrate that that these two things are not in contradiction. So, and then the third thing that we will maybe just sniff at is because we were trying to read or to bring something from Aaron Manning or Brian Musumi that would be somehow relevant here, and we didn't really find something that was not. But then, just at the last moment, we start to look again at the book by Stamatia Bogdanova, Moving Without the Body, where she tries to look at, let's say, digital and network technologies in relation to dance and performance. But it's also trying to understand how movement is actually present within the digital. And she's thinking through discretization, so what it means to cut up, which is like usually perceived as the where the big difference is between the life movement and the digitized movement. And she has a much more interesting understanding of this context. And somehow that brings us then back to the work of Musumi. So it's a kind of it's a like a hook. like a bridge. So. I don't know. Yeah, we read usually just by we read one by one, and this helps to hear when things become illegible.
In this case, it's kind of comfortably already packeted.
Yeah.
<in a,
laughs>
I think
this
is
we read loud.
Yeah.
We read like
and we kind of
And it helps, it's nice to hear each other's voice, but also to pick up when things become too complicated. It's easier to stop. So, and we'll just go for an hour and then switch to the other text. So it can be that we don't get to the end, but that's all right. You can take it.
Yes.
You want?
Okay.
You want to start, Alex?
Yeah, okay.
What's this one?
The vector of text, yeah. And that's basically a chapter, because we have all this hacker information, envelope, vector.
So I start.
Yeah.
Vector. The vector is viral. Borrows. The word is now a virus. The flu virus may once have been a healthy lung cell. It is now a parasitic organism that invades and damages the lungs. The word may once have been a healthy neural cell. It is now a parasitic organism that invades and damages the central nervous system. And the means by which the word or the virus moves from host to host is the vector. The vector is the way and means by which a given pathogen travels from one population to another. Water is a vector for cholera, bodily fluids for HIV. By extension, a vector may be any means by which anything moves. Vectors of transport move objects and subjects. Vectors of communication move information.
Which way are we going?
I can go.
Telegraph, telephone, television, telecommunications. These terms are not just particular vectors, but a general abstract capacity that they bring into the world and expand. All are forms of telesthesia, or perception at a distance. Starting with the telegraph, the vector of telesthesia accelerates at the speed at which information moves relative to all other things. Telesthesia produces the abstract speed by which all the other speeds are measured and monitored.
Okay. I'm trying to put telesthesia somehow back in the.
Ah, yeah, of course, the telegraph is the maybe the first stream in that sense.
Yeah.
Because that's also, I mean, you have a specific packet size, let's say, of the Morse code or like whatever code is used.
Optical telegraphy.
Even
better.
Yeah, that's also, and you have then the packet of the letter that will be propagated. And there the vector is vision or like light.
Yeah, but it's also like, sorry, this is last sentence, this is you produce the abstract speed by which all other speeds are measured. This is also super interesting because like looking at optical telegraphy systems, they were before used during Napoleon to synchronize the territory, like to synchronize all clocks that were on this line. So the speed that actually goes in hand with that bandwidth speed is determining at the end very many sub-products and sub-processes along those networks.
I thought it was interesting that, like, I mean, first I thought this abstract speed is the speed of light, because it's funny that also in the visual telegraphy, it's still the speed of light, speed. But then you have the interpretation and the kind of the processing of the packet, let's say, that is what takes time. But actually, the transmission is like this speed, and all this telegraph, telecom, television, telecommunication is the speed of light. The ground. But then you have all other timings that intervene.
Yeah.
Translation, redirection, and flow management.
Yeah, that's pretty. Sorry, just the last part, like in Frankfurt, for instance, the stock market is also located next to the knot in order to have the minimal time of transmission of information to that stock market close. Like, otherwise you could lose whatever amount of money or something.
The development of the vector creates the space within which the abstraction of property brings more and more of nature under the reign of the commodity. Marx, capital, by its nature, drives beyond every spatial barrier. Thus, the creation of the physical conditions of exchange, the means of communication and transport, the annihilation of space by time, becomes an extraordinary necessity for it. Only it is not capital, but the vector that provides the material means for this annihilation of particular traditions and envelopes. Capital, as a stage of the abstraction of property, enters the world only through the material development of the vector which carries it, and all forms of property further and further into the world. So he shifts this annihilation of space by time to be a function that the vector does, or which for Marx was capital, and he kind of shifts it
to the vector. But
the,
I would say it's like both capital and, I mean, the capital is not gone, no, from
no,
this.
No, but it says that the capital flows on the vector.
Yes.
Yeah.
He does also some stacking.
Exactly.
Want me to continue? The extraordinary necessity of the vector for capital leads to the capture of capital and its interest by a new ruling class that exploits capital's dependence on the vector. The vectoralist class. The vectoralist class emerges out of capital, just as capital emerged out of pastoralist class, as a specialized interest that gravitates towards the most abstract aspects of property, and discovers the leverage that control over abstraction can bring in relation to the rest of its former class. As the vectors of telesthesia differentiate communication from the vectors of transport, Information emerges as an abstraction ripe for commodification in all of its aspects, as a stock, as a flow, as a vector.
Even more than the pastoralist and capitalist classes before it, the vectorialist class depends on the advance hackers produce in order to maintain their competitive advantage and the profitability of their enterprises. Where owners of land and capital may dominate through the sheer level of investment required, the vectoral class relies on a form of property subject to constant hacks that create qualitatively new form of production and devalue the old means of production. The vectoral class invests the surplus it appropriates into aching to an unprecedented degree and bases the fortunes of its enterprises on intellectual property. Its investment in aching is hardly disinterested. Its search is for every new ways to vectorialize information in the form of a commodity.
Once information has become the object of a regime of property, a vectoral class emerges to extract its margin from the ownership of information. This class competes among itself for the most lucrative ways to commodify information as a resource. With the commodification of information comes its vectorialization. Extracting a surplus from information requires technologies capable of transporting information through space, but also through time. The storage of information may be as valuable as its transmission. And the archive is a vector through time, just as telesthesia is a vector through space. The whole potential of space and time becomes the object of the vectoral class.
The vectoral class comes into its own once it is in the possession of powerful technologies for vectoralizing information. Information becomes something separate from the material conditions of its production and circulation. It is extracted from particular localities, cultures, forms, and distributed in ever wider circles and is inside of property. The abstraction of information from the world becomes, in turn, the means of abstracting the world from itself.
Class determines how information stocks or flows as well as communication vectors. A stock of information is an archive, a body of information maintained through time that has enduring value. A flow of information is the capacity to extract information of temporary value out of events and to distribute it widely and quickly. A vector is the means of achieving either the temporal distribution of a stock or the spatial distribution of a flow of information. Vectoral power, as a class power, arises from ownership and control of all key aspects.
It's quite, like in here, for example, it really talks to how, like all the companies that do one thing, they tend to shift into the other. So like the companies that before were more doing kind of data center, they also move into actually buying network pieces and so on, because it's from the control of both that you can actually exert more control and therefore more revenue. And it's interesting how he puts in this time-space frame, because yeah, never really thought in that sense. So.
Can you quickly, because it's quite dense, this tree.
Yeah, maybe before it was more like when it, the one before it says that the storage of information may be as valuable as its transmission.
Mm-hmm.
And the archive, so it's the storage of information. So for example, the data center is the vector through time. So like with all this cloud storage, you kind of put there a thing that is kept there through time. And, but as telesthesia is a vector through space. So you also want to be able to access this information wherever you are,
mm-hmm.
like as with this cutting of distances.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this cutting of time of when you put things in what storage, but also the network to
mm-hmm.
kind of access this thing in any place.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when they can exert control on both of the aspects, then you have a much higher, well, both efficiency in organizing these flows, but also like ways to capture the way in which you do this, or the way in which revenue over the content distributed or advertisement, like basically all the parasitical
mm.
aspects to these functions that are creating revenue for.
Mm-hmm.
But just like, because it's not really an archive somehow, no?
What?
The storage of the information.
Mm.
Like it's not really an archive in the sense that you can go there and rediscover connection and things that otherwise would not be.
No,
but
I think this is...
He's talking about three, you know?
Yeah.
It's storage, archive, plus... what's the last one?
There's this.
The means.
The means.
Transmission.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Transmission.
And the archive is a vector through time, he says. So,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, maybe it's also the access that's indexing where files are, or
mm-hmm.
to have accessibility through a description of files.
Right, it's already a... like a very structured archive. It's more like a, I don't know, like a library already, less than an archive.
I mean, it depends on your
yeah.
definition
yeah.
of
yeah.
archive, but
yeah.
if you include YouTube as an archive of videos, which is a very questionable
yeah.
definition,
yeah, very questionable,
I
yeah. Okay, but then
yeah.
archive is more meant, like
yes,
a more structured.
More, like almost technical
yeah.
Use of the term.
Yeah.
Hmm.
But I mean, I think that money uses stock. That's
mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Stock, maybe.
Reserve.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think that's
mm-hmm.
The vector not only abstracts information from the particular conditions of its production, it abstracts every other relation with which it comes into contact. The expansion of the reach of markets, states, armies, cultures, from local to national to supranational forms, is conditioned by the development of the vectors along which information travels to thread them together. The vector traverses any envelope, expanding it, exploring it, or provoking it to lick and seal itself tight.
The irreversible abstraction of information comes at the point where vectors of telesthesia are hacked into being that free information from the velocity of movement of objects and subjects. Mm. Once information can move faster than people or things, it becomes the means by which people and things are to be meshed together in the interests of productive activity in ever-expanding envelopes. Once the vectors of telesthesia, with their superior speed, size, control of vectors of movement, a third nature arises with the power to direct and shape second nature. But like any everyday experience, it seems natural. The vector becomes natural as third nature becomes historical.
So is second nature society here, or?
Yeah, what? Because it's first and third, first and third. No, like, I guess. Oh. I think it's objects, subjects.
The second one,
no.
The one below talks about the second nature.
I think it's a third nature.
I mean, it starts with
objects and subjects.
Does that one of the first sentences?
People and things.
Yeah.
But the next paragraph seems to be about that, no?
Yeah. I think Alex will explain.
The vectors of movement abstract from the geography of nature and provide the axis along which collective human labor transforms nature into second nature. Second Nature offers a new home in the world in which freedom is wrested from necessity, but where class rule imposes yet new necessities on the producing classes. The vectors of telesthesia further abstract second nature from itself, producing a third nature in which new freedoms are wrested from necessity, and new necessities produced by class domination. But as the vector brings more and more abstraction into the world, it also opens more and toward the virtual. The geography of third nature becomes a virtual geography.
These terms of nature are really taken from Marx here.
Mm-hmm.
Like the, it's really about the first nature, which is the nature as grown. The second nature is the nature where, like, it seems like nature, where production is basically enforced on the resources,
mm-hmm.
and that comes together with the ruling class that actually controls a proletariat or however. And then the third nature is that what they bring into aspect to argue, okay, there is. As soon as things get virtual and speed up by telesthesia, then you have another form of power exercising and kind of, I don't know, maybe redistributing this whole notions of classes that was present in the second nature.
Mm-hmm.
So the second nature is how capitalist society perceives reality, basically.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Third nature is how information society. Or how, I don't know, Victorian society.
Exactly, it brings about a new form of power, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
It is, but.
Yeah.
But also a new reality, like our understanding of
reality. Yeah.
Reality.
And the freedoms rested?
Well, then.
Battled out.
Yeah.
That capitalist society undoes the kind of structural domination of the previous society of, for example, feudal relations and so on, but it sets a new set of rules that create a new set of, a new type of domination.
Yeah.
So.
Just as a second nature extracts itself from nature, yet depends on it. So too does third nature extract itself from nature and depend on it. Third nature is not transcendence or escape from nature, but merely the release of the virtuality of the nature into the world as the production of collective human labor.
Yeah, this virtuality, but with the coming of telesthesia, the communication vector becomes a power over and above both nature as well as second nature. The vector intensifies the exploitation of nature by providing an ever-present third nature, within which nature is a lot of nature. is grasped as an object, as a quantifiable resource to be commodified and exploited by the ruling classes. The world itself becomes objectified.
Yeah, but it's questionable whether this is not always given already or not.
Mm-hmm.
But what is nature discussion with Pietro?
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether nature as such exists and whether the world is really something that is objectifying things or not, I think it's really
this is
essentialist discussion here.
Some feminist, no?
Each ruling class of the vectorial era appropriates the world as it finds it and transforms it into a world ripe for appropriation by its successor, deploying ever more abstract means. The pastoralist class appropriates nature as its property and extracts a surplus from it. The capitalist class transforms it towards a second nature, a built environment in which the resistance of nature to objectification is mitigated, if not overcome. The vectoralist class appropriates second nature as the material conditions for the reign of a third nature, in which resources both natural and social in origin may be represented as things.
The vector intensifies the setting to work of the producing classes, but in the form of commodity production. Not just nature is objectified and qualified, but so too is a second nature. The producing classes find themselves transformed into object of quantification and calculation. Third nature becomes the environment within which the production of second nature accelerates and intensifies, becoming global and in its apprehension of itself. Second nature, in the grip of a third nature, is at the same time the worship within which nature itself is appropriated in an objectified form. Nature appears as the world, and the world appears as a nature, precisely at the moment that an objectifying power sizes it in its totality as a resource.
Telestesia allows the quantification of all things, their comparison and the direction of resources according to the creation of the world simultaneously as a field of objects that can be brought into productive relation. Nature and second nature, objectified as resources, are simultaneously available for calculation and mobilization. Space becomes subject to instantaneous command. But what is rational as a particular appropriation of the world combines with rational as a particular appropriation of the world combines with every other equally rational appropriation in an irrational whole. What amounts to the same thing, considered as a static equilibrium, the vectoral order is indeed an order, considered as a dynamic unfolding of an event. It drives logically to the exhaustion of its resources.
The vectoral class ascends to the illusion of an instantaneous and global plane of calculation and control. But as the productive classes of the world come to know only too well, it is not the vectorist class that really holds subjective power over the objective world. The vector itself usurps the commanding role, becoming the sole repository of will towards a world that can be apprehended only in its communified form. This emerging global plane is at once totalizing and emphatically partial. The totality emerges under the sign of a mere aspect.
The vectoral class unleashes this third nature upon the world and profits from it, either directly or indirectly. It profits from the producing classes and also from the other ruling classes, to whom it sells the vectoral capacity to grasp the world in its objectified form, the capacity of the vector. Sometimes the vectoral class competes with the capitalist and the pastoralist classes. Sometimes it colludes and collaborates. The state form adjusts itself accordingly. The index of the relationship of the vectoral class to state power is the transformation of the laws governing vectors, such as airways and networks and regulating patents, copyrights and trademarks. When thou itself and the air itself have been subordinated to their representation as property, the vectoral class is in charge.
Yeah, this is kind of useful, I think. Still, I'm wondering about this because somehow it feels that with Netflix it's both. It's one and the same in a way, the capitalist class and the vectoralist class.
Yeah.
Or I don't see.
But that's more
collision.
Yeah. Or
collision is collaboration.
Yeah, actually, because it's not like a thing as a class, but more like an abstract way of reading how,
like,
yeah,
stacking together.
Yeah. And
the becoming vectoral of this world, I just like keep on thinking like, oh, this is 18 years ago. It didn't help. Or maybe the opposite.
Yet.
I don't know. The becoming vectoral of this world is the release of the productive potential of all its resources, and at the same time the creation of a category of resource for any and everything in it. The vectoral is not only the potential to conceive of everything as a resource, but also the potential to bring that resource into productive relation to any other resource whatsoever. The vector turns particular geographies into virtual geography, offering its specific qualities as exchangeable quantities.
Mm-hmm. But this is where I have trouble distinguishing the vector from the capital. In this operation, it's
the turning the particular geographies into
and of considering everything as a resource.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because that's
like this is very fundamental to the
but in a way
capital economy as much as in this description of vectoral.
But wait, vectoral not only the potential to conceive of everything as a resource.
Yeah.
But also the potential to bring that research source into productive relation to any other resource.
Maybe
so
think
the networking of the resources is
Maybe the important here is the any.
Yeah.
Any other.
Well,
relation.
And
the relation
to any other.
Well, and also that, yeah. But it's also the fact that it's not just the fact that you're going to be sold an access to content, but the fact that you're going to be observed about as a population about the access to this content, and this will feed back in the production of the content. So like this type of relation is in a way the
third level of the content.
Yeah,
the
additional aspect.
The reign of the vector is one in which any and everything can be apprehended as a commodity. Everything that appears is something distinct, something of value, and which may be transformed at will into any other thing, which may be brought together with any other thing of value in the creation of a new value. The reign of the vector is the reign of value.
Having set third nature in motion, the vectoral class finds itself increasingly unable to control its creation. Subjectivity resides not in the vectoral class, but in the cumulative production of its activity, the third nature that arises out of the proliferation of the vector. This third nature comes moreover to represent to itself its own limitations. These limitations do not escape the attention of the productive classes who must daily live with them. The third nature fails to allocate natural resources in such a way that second nature could ever be sustained. Third nature fails to allocate natural resources in such a way that second nature could ever be sustained.
Yeah,
I
said,
well, I mean, I can only think of the, like the, what we saw with the Google data centers, that they arrive with promises to to inject money into areas.
Yeah, that would be the failure to allocate. So the fact that it promises to kind of reorganize all the flows, while actually it's really focusing on the ones that create, that structures its own power, and not really for restructuring the world. But
no.
But how it comes to represent to itself its own limitations, that I don't.
That but maybe the next. There's always a next episode.
Exactly. There may be cold comfort for the productive classes in this. They may not control the means by which information is extracted from their lives and returned to them in form of the commodity. They may not control the allocation of resources based on the instantaneous quantification of all things in the world, but the point may be reached where no class does. The electoral class produces a means of domination over the world that comes to dominate even its own exertions and extortions.
Okay.
Just gets more complex. Just resolve anything.
It's like string, you know?
Well, I could I could think maybe this strange effect in which, for example, people working in the Silicon Valley has this kind of really being careful with their kids about how much they access, and like you have this but it's not really
I'm trying to imagine what he was thinking about, because again, like, that recent, these types of
maybe it was an abstract instruction of how can you exploit you know, all the new technologies that are in front of us. So maybe we shouldn't read it as a critique or a potential you know, warning, but maybe it's just followed up by very clever people to turn completely against
script.
Itself.
It's a score.
It's a manual.
that's why it is.
No, yeah, I think also because it's still talking about subjectivity here, no? On 333, the like class. Subjectivity resides not in the victorious class, but in the cumulative product of its activity, the third nature that derives out of proliferation of the vector. And then, like in the 334, they may not control the means by which information is extracted from their lives and returned to them in front of the informed commodity. So they're extracting something that they might think is quantified from subjectivity, but in the end they don't really know what it is actually.
Yeah.
Like they lose the control over their own.
That's the productive classes.
The productive classes, but then there is the vector class.
Yeah,
sorry.
Indeed.
More like. So it's like there is like a delegation on the means. So it is the means of domination of the world that come to dominate even the.
Bye bye.
Ciao.
Thank you.
Yeah, but isn't the vectoral class
produces a means over the world?
Isn't the vectoral class doing the same thing as the second nature productive class doing, but in a way that they don't have the complete control over the thing?
But this says no one has the complete control.
Yeah.
It's just paving the way for the fourth nature, no?
Hmm?
Like, you know, I cannot be complete and I'm very clever, but you know, maybe I can make some niches that can be filled in by them. But yet another class. Sorry.
That's the cold comfort. We can try maybe the next one. Maybe get into more trouble.
The vector is a power the world over.
The world over.
The vector is a power the world over.
Over the world?
All over
the world. All over the world.
Ah, okay. But the power that is not evenly distributed. Nothing in the nature of the vector determines that it must be deployed here rather than there, between this person rather than those, between these cities rather than these hinterlands, these empires rather than these peripheries. Nothing about the vector in the abstract says what flows along it must only flow one way.
from boss to hand, from metropolis to province, from empire to colony, from the overdeveloped to the underdeveloped world. And yet, this is the vector as we find it. This open potential, yet limited application, is the very condition of the vector. That is quite...
Now we get it.
Hmm?
Now we get it.
I don't know, but...
Certainty of understanding appears.
Yeah, but it's good how it can call, like this, if you see this information site, it can call up all the kind of structure from capitalist society in theory, but in practice you have a lot of crystallized, like the colonial is still there,
yeah.
If you look at how networks and goods flows, etc., they still have a tendency to keep in their direction. As a figure in geometry, a vector is a line of fixed length, but of no fixed position. As a figure in technology, a vector is a means of is a means of movement that has fixed qualities of speed and capacity, but no predetermined application. A vector is partly determined, but also partly open. A vector is partly actual, partly virtual. All that is determined by the technology is the form in which information is objectified, not the where and the how. That vectoral development is uneven development. Calls for analysis that looks beyond the fetish of this technical, of the technical, to the form of class power that seizes upon its virtual openness and renders it as actual inequality. Wait.
Yeah.
Why is vectoral development uneven development?
I mean, it doesn't really describe why yet, but it says...
But it takes it as a given. That vectoral development is uneven development.
Well, not as a given, but as a found, as an observed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We find the situation that's unequal.
But also I think it is unequally given because it still follows, as we just mentioned, like paths of, you know, capitalist structures and colonialist structures.
Hmm.
Like it's still, you know, always in forms of the ones that govern things that own certain structures and the others that are subject to it.
So, so on the one hand, it needs to make any other flow possible, but it still flows the same way. But then why exactly that happens there? Or how it can happen even?
But I think to point it out as an inequality is kind of important because, for this ideology of the discourse that everyone is equal, net neutrality, whatever, it's like by its foundation already not the case.
Who was it?
Me?
15 more minutes.
Who was reading?
I read, but maybe I jumped.
No, I read before.
Then it's me. The whole life of the whole of life in the most overdeveloped parts of the world presents itself as a vast accumulation of vectors. It is the proliferation and intensification of the vector that constitutes the development of the overdeveloped world. Whether this be an advance towards the furthest regions of hell or not remains to be seen.
18 years ago.
In the underdeveloped world, the vector becomes the means by which the transformation of nature into second nature is effected. But where in the overdeveloped world, this process at least affords the productive classes the opportunity of struggling against their local ruling classes, in the undeveloped world, the productive classes must struggle against the global and abstract third nature. The resources, natural and social, that are detected and appropriated there become the means for the further development of overdevelopment elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. No, that's quite.
He couldn't suppress his poetic impulses.
But it's nice how this the underdeveloped and overdeveloped is kind of this axis in relation to the capitalist society as such. But then how this kind of next step, it's also where it can be somehow questioned, because it's also where it's exerting the structural changes of, yeah, of still the mining of the materials that allow to enact this third nature, whatever.
You got four kids, no? You're like, based on this, you can make a manifest for the 22nd century.
But it's interesting how, like, there is a scale jump, no? In the overdeveloped world, there's like it affords for struggling against local ruling classes,
mm-hmm.
and the underdeveloped is against global and abstract.
Such as perhaps how it always was in the colonial dimension of actual development, but where once the underdeveloped world struggled directly against a forcible appropriation of kind of communication, now it struggles against an abstract and vectoral power everywhere and nowhere. Once upon a time, the colonies were ruled by battalions of soldiers, now by a phalanx of bankers. The underdeveloped world has little choice but to acquire vectoral power for the defense of its envelopes against the vectoral power emanating from the overdeveloped world.
You want to look back? The vector perfected would be the relation that holds in that world, which is in every one of its aspects and modes potentially becoming every other world. That this world has not come to pass yet is indeed the virtual aspect of the actual world as we find it. That this world has not come to pass, yet is indeed the virtual aspect of the actual world as we find it, leads to a questioning of the powers that limit this potential. Constraint is what must be accounted for, the constraint imposed by the direction of the development of the vector by its modified form and its subordination to the rule of the vectoral class.
The hacker class seeks the liberation of the vector from the reign of the commodity. But
now
not
we get the hero, not the heroes.
But not to set it indiscriminately free, rather to subject it to collective and democratic development. The hacker class can release the virtuality of the vector only in principle. It is up to an alliance of all the productive classes to turn that potential to actuality. Once the productive classes have actual control over the vector, then its virtual powers can be realized as a process of collective becoming.
Is this with an optimist tone?
No. It's with a Marxist tone.
Yeah.
So you need to seize the in a way.
The means of production.
You need, but and again, as the problem with Marx is also that it's not to, or certain Marxism is not to undo some structure, but actually that by taking control of the structures,
taking
you can change them.
The
you can change what they mean and the domination they produce. So.
Under the control of the vectoral class, the vector proceeds by means of objectification and produces a corresponding subjectivity. Just as the object becomes an abstract value, so too does the subject. Are we okay? A vectoral subjectivity arises which is not the universal enlightened subject long dreamt of in the overdeveloped world. Vectoral subjectivity is abstract, but not universal. It acquires its specificity as the internalizing of the differentiation of values that appear on the abstract plane of the vector. This subjectivity is as partial as vectoral objectivity, the difference being that object does not know it has been appropriated as a resource by the vector, while the subject potentially does. The subject experiences its partiality as loss or lack, which it may seek to fulfill through the very same field of values, the field of the vector, that produces the lack in the first place. Or it may hack the vector, opening it to the production of qualities excluded from the dominant form of communication under class rule.
But why would this quality be?
I'm wondering if this is somehow, or it makes me think about the question of bias, basically, of how, like, you have algorithmic processes that kind of are biased because they're based on biased training data. And how the promise is that you can kind of, that it can be fulfilled through the very same field of values, so that you could have an algorithm that fixes the bias of, but yeah.
Okay, like a corrector.
Yeah,
but still it's the hacker, like the subjectivity that emerges here, still a productive one, like one that still produces qualities.
I wonder what this differentiation there, or especially here, means between, like, before everything was quantified, that's why it could flow into this vectorial form of production. And now, what would be the qualities that would be opened up?
Yeah, because I mean, this is exactly what I was wondering. Like, if it's, I mean, why quality is produced? I mean, why is it spoken as such? I mean, when there are other definitions of hacking that are more based on using differently, you know, or not producing.
The vector class struggles at the very turn to maintain its subjective power over the vector, but as it continues to profit by the proliferation of the vector, some capacity over it always escapes control. In order to market and profit by the information it peddles over the vector, it must in some degree address the vast majority of its producing classes in terms of their real desires. The vectoral class finds itself always opening the vector towards the producing classes and then struggling to shut or reappropriate the very desires it has called forth. The veritable riot of representations produces inevitable riots against representation. Right.
It remains only for the producing classes, addressed as if they were productive agents of desire, to really produce themselves as and for themselves, and use the available vectors for a collective becoming. This struggle for class power on the part of the producing classes is a struggle for collective becoming. It joins in with the planetary struggle for survival, in which the whole of nature, in all its dimensions, must appear as a multitude of living collective forces. But yeah, which, as you say, it seems like it's always producing for in different ways, right? So it's
the great challenge to the hacker class is not just to create the abstractions by which the vector may develop, but the forms of collective expressions that may overcome the limits not just of commodification, but of objectification in general, of which commodification is just the most pernicious and one-sided development. But the hacker class cannot change the world on its own. It can offer itself out for hire to vectoralist class for the maintenance of the reign of the commodity. Or it can express itself as a gift to the producing classes, pushing abstraction beyond the bounds of the commodity form. The hacker class virtualizes, the producing classes actualize.
Okay.
We need some reproductive hackers. Yeah,
exactly. Reproductive hackers?
Eh?
Reproductive hackers?
Reproductive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Reproductive economists.
And what is pernicious?
Ah. What is it?
Like evil.
I don't know. What is pretty
fucked up?
I don't know. Pernicious. You speculate.
Okay, let's try again. Of which commodification is the most fucked up and one-sided development?
Okay. Okay, we solved it.
Again, file of bug.
The great challenge to the hacker class is not just to create the abstractions. The interest of the hacker class in the production of the interest of the hacker class in the production of production, in the abstraction of the world, the expression of the virtuality of nature, can be brought into accord with the needs and interests of nature itself. But this too is only a step towards another history, a history where nature expresses itself as a self, as neither object nor subject, but as its infinite virtuality. A history in which the production of a fourth yet affirms the nature of nature itself.
It
gets a bit pyrotechnic now, no?
How do we read this? Like the interest of the hacker class, hacker class in the production of production, in the abstract abstraction of the world, the expression of the virtuality of nature. It's kind of
the nature of
nature of nature.
I think this is a bit pernicious.
Yes, that's also pretty
interesting. Yeah, that's pretty fucked up. So do the stars refer to the notes?
Yeah,
awesome.
There are some notes.
Yeah, in the...
Yeah.
Where are they?
Well, it's the last two pages.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Text.
It's text,
quote.
Yeah, there's just some 13 and 15.
Yeah.
I think we start with barns.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
So these ones don't get, no.
No, the previous
okay,
chapter.
So who's the author of this?
Mackenzie Work? You think he's pernicious?
Mackenzie what work?
He's so sure that it is.
And the year?
I think, well, around 2000, the first version. Nice.
Yes, there are things that cannot be quantified.
It's 2006.
Six?
Mm.
Six.
But the text has been around 1999 or something.
And that was the first essay already in 1986.
86?
I know, but that's another hacker's manifesto.
Yeah, the conscious of the hacker.
That's actually a hacker that wrote it. Well, I don't know if he's a vectoralist or...
I think he's a vectoralist, no?
Yeah, in a way he proposes... I think this is a vector he proposes somehow.
No, I think so.
Can I read you the last email that I got? It's called Hacker Access. Did you get it?
No.
Hi Peter, I wanted to check back in on last time to see if you'd be interested in attending HackerX on June 14 in Brussels. We have a great lineup of companies attending so far, including a whole range of companies.
So the hackers.
Come meet great companies and developers in the area. No commitment, just good fun. Great opportunity. Smart engineers.
It's good fun.
Thanks again. Feel free to bring a friend.
Yeah.
Unless you want to know, what is this thing of this hacker?
Well, but in a way, the fact that, I mean, that's because maybe it's also extracted from the flow of the book.
Mm-hmm.
But before, I mean, that's why the hackers manifest. So it's like to basically try also to radicalize or like to show that he defines the hacker class is basically constructing this spectral power. It's they're the ones developing the means through which vectoral power institutes itself. So that this means also realizing this and choosing basically an agency in this.
Well, I find it interesting that it brings really into play the resources that are at stake and the forms and means of production that are at stake, which otherwise, you know, it's so abstract that it's never visible, it's never really brought into. I find it quite great it's from 2004 bringing this aspect into. What is a bit strange is this reduction on productivity and on production and quantification. That's a bit like really one directional and doesn't mean give any.
Not a lot of space for.
No, exactly. For anything
else. But I mean, there's also the critique in general on the Hacker Manifesto that's even in its trying to radicalize and make understand what was happening, certain aspects of the position of the.
Yeah,
and it does the. It can do these abstract moves that sometimes work, but then when you just put everything under production, like also it's just one type of production basically, then it's like this
abstraction
works again.
Care, maintenance, all this kind of stuff.
It's all put in one.
Box. Okay. And there's some.
Is it
warm
for me?
Yeah.
It's
not very warm. For me, it's okay.
Thank you for this vector text.
Yeah, thanks for all the vectors.
But I never think of vector as a fixed length. For me, a vector is disconnected from the length. If you think about the graphics,
exactly. Usually, the length is always another quantifier in the direction of what a vector is.
Yeah, a vector is a direction. Yeah. It's only
I would
a
say, like a factorial, as we use it in graphics, it's in a scalable. So it doesn't have a fixed length.
I think maybe it's like in that it does, it's more the fact that to define a vector, you give kind of the. It doesn't have a starting point, basically. I think in this three axis view or something. So you just say that it goes some amount x, some amount x, some amount y, but not where it starts, so it can be applied in any place of a field. But also
what I find also is interesting that the vector, of course, like it's an abstract geometry that makes maybe a mean of points, but the mean of the points are never written in the line itself. I'm wondering what is the non-linear inside. There are so many struggles. There are so many things that are not so linear to be brought under one kind of direction. Like it's subsuming many things.
Mm-hmm.
And as you mentioned, like what about all those layers inside that are maybe not so one directional in themselves, but there is always a friction in between them.
But you also use vector for this kind of machine, like with this algorithmic way of working with language or with different elements. You kind of abstract a whole set of elements into one vector, because then it can be put into a field of vectors. I'm wondering how that works in relation to that. I mean, in a way.
Yeah, it goes ahead. It goes totally in hand with this idea of quantifying all these things, and then of course, then you get your clean vector, but all the noise that is happening around it is blended out, and all the friction that is happening around it is blended out of that. Out of that abstraction.
Which is just not, because that's exactly the vectorial where the noise is not blended out. It's only in
the noise.
So I think there's something else with the, let's say, quantified and the vectorial.
Why do you
To vectorize the world, would you reduce it to just one type of world? Like everything becomes
as long as it's flowable, it can be different.
So it goes to.
As long as it can move or can be moved along those vectors, it can be different. It doesn't have to be the same. But it has to fulfill that requirement.
It would be the is that the ethics of the vectorizing?
I would say, But it means, of course, that by making itself available for those flows, it also changes its. It's nature, it's nature, and it's politics, even when it looks different or doesn't look the same.
To be like everything would be signaled, right? I mean, in this sense, like algorithms are signals. It's a system of signals that then produce different things. But so there is something about subtracting everything to them. But then, I mean, maybe the combinations can reconstitute things again.
But that's what I was meaning with this noise aspect, exactly.
Yeah.
Like if everything becomes signal, then you kind of blend out all the noise that is going next to it.
Yes.
Or
I mean, even the noise is there, right? Like,
Or is subsumed under signal in order to be controlled. I don't know. But I thought, like.
Yeah, I'm just.
Nice.
I was thinking about
sweet.
Good
things.
She grasped the vector.
But also acted on it to a certain
level. And wrote some first nature.
Exactly.
Thank you.
What were you talking about?
Well, the question of noise, basically.
Yeah.
Like if it's, and also, like in a way that, so like if the vector, it's not so much. It's kind of independent from the content, basically. It's just the sheer possibility of a flow of content.
Yeah.
Then in that sense, noise content, it doesn't really matter because the function is the flow. But how does that mean that everything becomes... Well, so in that sense, as third nature, content and noise, they have the same value, you know? This actually.
So we join? Yeah, to have the fascinating.
It's going to be a landing.
Yeah, we talked about the bonus.
And if you get bored, I think after half of the text,
31 minutes.
Of.
Come on.
I think
he's also listening to him.
Maximum 39.
Hmm?
If you get bored, we listen to him because I think this is also
a podcast.
Yeah.
I know. Then we'll lie down.
Vectors coming.
You want to read the whole text?
No way.
You have.
Yeah.
Right? No. The first thing is a bit
something
like explanation of DRM and WQC, you know? And
well, that's kind of useful.
Yeah?
Because we went through it, so I think here we have a few.
Okay, so let's go for it. So let's start?
Yeah.
DRM's dead canary, how we just lost the web, what we learned from it, and what we need to do next. Right.
So that was this ideology of the free internet, etc.
Sounds like a whole acronym.
GDC, HWG,
more. We have many
more.
So EFF, so the Electronic Frontier Foundation, so that E is part of.
What? Electronic?
Frontier Foundation. Has been fighting against DRM, digital rights movement, and the laws behind it for a decade and a half, intervening in the US Broadcast Flag, the UN Broadcasting Treaty, the European DVB CTCM standard, the W3C EME standard, and many other skirmishes, battles, and even wars over the years.
DVB is what? Digital Video Broadcast? CTCM, what is that? No, not important.
Control something.
Content provider
something.
Control.
Content provider.
Content, yeah.
Copy, computer.
WQC, www consortium.
Personal computer.
Yeah, this I know.
Yeah, you know, but it's, since when? UN
is
United
is
Nations and US is United States.
W3.
Okay, so with that long history behind us, there are two things we want you to know about DRM. One, everybody on the inside secretly knows that DRM technology is irrelevant, so the way you do the blocking. But DRM law is everything. And two, the reason companies want DRM has nothing to do with copyright. These two points have just been demonstrated in a messy, drawn-out fight over the standardization of DRM in browsers. And since we threw a lot of blood and treasure at that fight, one thing we hope to salvage is an object lesson that will drive these points home and provide a roadmap for the future of DRM fighting.
Mm-hmm. DRM is technologically bankrupt. DRM law is deadly. Here's how DRM works at a high level. A company wants to provide a customer, you, with digital asset, like a movie, a book, a song, a video, a game, or an app, but they want to control what you do with that file after you get it. Okay. So there's an issue with temporality. So they encrypt the file. We love encryption.
Just don't get us wrong.
This we is a.
This they we no.
I think we here is with the EFF.
EFF. Yeah.
That's the
and
we,
the link I think
EFF.
It links to an
yeah.
EFF article on why
yeah.
They love encryption.
Okay. Okay. So they encrypt the file. We love encryption. Encryption works with relatively little effort. Anyone can scramble a file.
Thank you.
So well that no one will ever be able to encrypt it unless they are provided with the key.
Are these missing pages?
Good. Let's say this is Netflix. They sent you a movie that's been scrambled and they want to be sure you can't save it and watch it later from your hard drive. But they also need to give you a way to view the movie too. At some point, that means unscrambling the movie. And there's only one way to unscramble a file that's been completely encrypted. You have to use the key. So Netflix also gives you the unscrambling key. But if you have the key, you can just unscramble the Netflix movies and save them to your hard drive. How can Netflix give you the key but control how you use it? Netflix has to hide the key somewhere on your computer, like in a browser extension or an app. This is where the technological bankruptcy comes in. Hiding something well is hard. Hiding something well in a piece of equipment that you give to your adversary to take away with them and do anything they want with is impossible.
But you can,
this is where I find the metaphorical use of words elusive.
What words?
Like hiding.
Key also. Because he's talking about the key. Well, actually, it has to do temporal functions. So the key we note as a metaphor of a spatial access blocker or opener, while here it's introducing temporal dimension to access or not.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it can still work.
Yeah.
It still functions as what it means, but also distorts. Or not this story.
It's your account, no? That is the key.
Yeah, but it's called key.
No.
It is.
I think, yeah.
No, it's a decryption key.
Yeah, so you have it's like you get the key from the space, for example.
Not the password.
You get the key from the space and they tell you only now. Then you won't be able to enter anymore.
No, because that's, I mean, if I understand well, then once you log in, that's,
tomorrow the same key will
but
not
it's
open.
More, it's more like you will never have the key in the hand, but it's going to be enacted through the computer and open and close.
Some other word, a key will operate.
At this, I understand that it's
maybe
abstraction, but it's metaphor to use the key.
Yeah, it's not like the door key, but it's like that key, basically, that being able to read is it's a shift, of course.
No, but it's okay.
But he does it not deliberately. It's a discursive thing because he wants you to think about the key, about something that's material.
Yeah.
And they want you to think about something metaphysically that only works if you have the right login and da-da-da, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But basically, it's a piece of code that just makes the whole thing work. So you have it somewhere, you just don't know it.
And this text wants to present it as very simple.
Actually,
I think.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's why he makes the link to encryption, so the technology that regulates this access, which is the technology that, and so he starts with saying everyone can encrypt, everyone can have keys and deal with them.
Mm.
But in this case, the simpleness, the keenness of the the process is being hidden. And that is where he tries to say this is technologically bankrupt, because technically you have the key.
It's more restricting you from using
it.
It's
a key, so you have a key, but it's going to be as if you don't have this key. That's the only way they can pretend it works.
Maybe you can find you can't find the keys that Netflix hid in your browser, but someone can. A bored grad student with a free weekend, self-taught genius decaying a chip in their basement, a competitor with a full-service lab, one tiny flaw in any part of the fragile wrapping around these keys, are there, and they are free. And once that flaw is exposed, anyone can write an app or a browser plugin that does have a save button. It's game over for the DRM technology. The keys escape pretty irregularly, just as fast as they can be revoked by the DRM companies. Shall I continue?
DRM gets made over the course of years by skilled engineers at the cost of millions of dollars. It gets broken in days by teenagers with hobbyist equipment. That's not because the DRM makers are stupid. It's because they are doing something stupid. Which is where the law comes in. DRM law gives rights holder more forceful, far-ranging legal powers than laws governing any other kind of technology. In 1998, Congress passed the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, whose section 1201 provides for felony liability for anyone commercially engaged in bypassing a digital rights management system. 5 years in prison and a $500,000 fine for a first offense. Fucking hell. Even.
What is this felony life?
Like a level of how criminal thing you did. Felony.
Okay.
Or whatever, sorry.
Yeah, I don't know actually. Like,
I have
criminal offense. So it's not that, but.
Misdemeanor.
You have misdemeanor,
felony.
Yeah.
I guess felony is a crime, or no?
Like a type, a group of crimes.
Yeah.
A category of badness.
Felony is a serious crime.
It's a serious
crime.
Felone.
Category of seriousness.
Felone.
In Italian, ancient Italian.
What does it mean?
Some bad guy, some pernicious guy.
Yeah.
Non criminale, ma veramente un serio di
criminalità. Nee. In Germany, a Straftäter.
Strafzeit.
Ein Krimineller. Straftäter is something that is comes from the criminal law, and the other one from the
overtreding, misdaad, criminal.
Misdaad, overtreding.
So basically, it's criminal, not a civil. It's a bad offense. This
is
bad.
Even non-commercial bypass of DRM is subject to liability. It also makes it legally risky to even talk about how to bypass the DRM system. So the law shores up DRM systems with a broad range of threats. If Netflix designs a video player that won't save a video unless you break some DRM, they now have the right to sue or seek or call the police on any rival that rolls out an improved alternative streaming client or a video recorder that works with Netflix. Such tools would not violate copyright law any more than a VCR or a TiVo does. But because that recorder would have to break Netflix DRM, they could use DRM law to crush it. DRM law goes beyond mere bans on tampering with DRM. Companies also use Section 1201 of the DMCA to threaten security researchers who discover flaws in their products.
I can testify that this is
yeah.
Really difficult.
Mm-hmm.
You're right now preparing for the work session, a visit to a lab that does research on nanotechnologies, so for implants.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a commercial lab that is super crazy about us visiting, like super nervous, and that we can't record and we can't like make notes and whatever, because they have non-disclosure agreements with companies. But then we're also working with a research group that is researching these technologies to see what technology flaws there are.
Mm-hmm.
And now Eduard Marin is not wanting us to record a talk because he's afraid
of this type of
And does he say on which laws?
It's super scary because it means like a group of interested citizens cannot come to find out about what is going on and discuss with researchers because they're just
Which of course is also another axis of where the ESF is working on, is that this means you all of a sudden cannot have open source.
Mm-hmm.
Like while open source has been a driving axis of how these things would circulate. Now all of a sudden you have something that it's not just they don't release the source, it's even illegal to try and understand how something works. So.
Do you remember the DCSS software? Yeah. The one that was making it possible to look at videos on a Linux system. It's just a software that bypassed the DRM and was kind of this very small tool, but it always works. And VLC had implemented it and they've withdrawn it.
Because otherwise they would
not because it doesn't work, because it works too well and it's so obvious that there's only one thing which can do it, is this, you know, highly targeted DCSS software. No?
No, no, no.
Scare politics, huh?
The law becomes a weapon. They can aim at anyone who wants to warn their customers, still you, that the products you are relying on aren't fit for use. That includes warning people about flaws in DRM that expose them to being hacked. It's not just the USA and not just the DMCA either. The US Trade Representative has convinced countries around the world to adopt a version of this rule.
DRM has nothing to do with copyrights. DRM law has the power to do untold harm because it affords corporations the power to control the use of their products after sale, the power to decide who can compete with them and under what circumstances, and even who gets to warn people about detective products. DRM law represents a powerful temptation. Defective products, not detective.
It
wasn't
nice.
Yeah, it works. Slip. Yeah. Some things that aren't copyright infringement, buying a DVD while you're on a holiday and playing it when you get home. Some things that aren't, okay. It is obviously not a copyright infringement to go into a store in New Delhi and buy a DVD and bring it home to, say, Topeka. Where is that? The rights holder made their movie, sold it to the retailer, and you paid the retailer the asking price. This is the opposite of copyright infringement. That's paying for works on the terms set by the rights holder. But because DRM stops you from playing out-of-region discs on your home player, the studios can invoke copyright law to decide where you can consume the copyrighted works you've bought fair and square. Other not infringements. Fixing your car. GM uses, General Motors uses digital rights management to control who can diagnose an engine and to force mechanics to spend tens of thousands of dollars to diagnostic information they could otherwise determine themselves or obtain from third parties. Refilling an ink cartridge. HP pushed out a fake security update that added DRM to millions of inkjet printers so that they refuse manufactured or third-party cartridges. Or toasting homemade bread. Though this hasn't happened yet. There's no reason that a company could not put digital rights management to control whose bread you can use. It's also not a copyright infringement to watch Netflix in a browser that Netflix hasn't approved to. It's not a copyright infringement to record a Netflix movie to watch it later. It's not a copyright infringement to feed a Netflix video to an algorithm that can warn you about upcoming stroke effects that can trigger life-threatening seizures in people who with photosensitive epilepsy.
It's
probably had a placeholder. You want to know more in my novel. That's what it's going.
It's to take it back to DRM is deadly.
Which brings us to the W3C. The W3C is the world's foremost open web standards body. A consortium holds members, companies, universities, government agencies, civil society groups and others engage in proactive wrangles over the best way to everyone to deliver web content. They produce recommendations, W3C speak for standards, that form the invisible struts that hold up the web. These agreements, produced through patient negotiation and compromise, represent an agreement by major stakeholders about the best or least worst way to solve thorny technological problems. In 2013, Netflix and a few other media companies convinced the W3C to start to work on a DRM system for the web. This DRM system, encrypted media extensions, represented a sharp departure from the W3C's normal business. First, EME would not be a complete standard. The organization would specify an API through which publishers, what is the API?
It's like an interface, so it's like a way in which the...
So the...
Yeah.
the abbreviation is application programming interface? Anyway, it's a way that that other like that applications can with specific groups or code words access certain features from a website, for example. So you could program something that could make use of this. So it would, and the idea is that it would not be implemented in the browser, but you would somehow have a way to make applications that could use this.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of compromise.
First, EME would not be a complete standard. The organization would specify an API through which publishers and browser vendors would make DRM work, but the actual content decryption module would be defined by the standard. That means that the EME was a standard in the name only. You started a browser company and followed all the W3C's recommendations, you still wouldn't be able to play back a Netflix video. For that, you'd need Netflix permission.
It's hard to overstate how weird this is. Web standards are about permissionless interoperability. Standards for formatting text mean that anyone can make a tool that can show you pages from the New York Times website, images from Getty, or interactive charts from Bloomberg. The companies can still decide who can see which pages on their websites by deciding who gets password and which parts of the website each password unlocks, but they don't get to decide to create the web browsing program you type the password into in order to access the website. The web in which every publisher gets to pick and choose which browsers you can use to visit their sites is a very different one from the historical web. Historically, anyone could make a new browser by making sure it adhered to W3C recommendations and then start to. And while the web has always been dominated by a few browsers, which browsers dominated have changed every decade or so, as new companies and even non-profits like Mozilla and Firefox overthrew the old order. Technologies that have stood in the way of this permissionless interoperability, for instance, patenting Humbert videos, have been seen as impediments to the idea of the open web and standardization opportunities. When the W3C starts making technologies that only work when they're blessed by a handful of entertainment companies, they're putting their fists on the scales in favor of ensuring that the current browser giants get to enjoy a permanent reign. But that's the least of it. Until EME, W3C standards were designed to give the users of the web, for example you, more control over what your computer did while you were accessing other people's websites. With EME, for the first time ever, W3C is designing technology that takes away your control. EME is designed to allow Netflix and other big companies to decide what your browser does, even especially when you disagree about what that should be. Since the earliest days of computing, there's been a simmering debate about whether computers exist to control their users or vice versa. As the visionary computer scientist and education specialist Seaman Papert put it, children should be programming the computer rather than being programmed by it. That applies equally about adults. Every W3C standard until 2017 was on the side of people controlling computers. EME breaks with that. It is a subtle but profound shift.
Why would the W3C do this? That is the 3 billion user question. The W3 version of the story goes something like this. The rise of apps has weakened the web. In the pre-app days, the web was the only game in town, so companies had to play by web rules. Open standards, open web. But now that apps exist and nearly everyone uses them, big companies can boycott the web, forcing their users into apps instead. That just accelerates the rise of apps and weakens the web even more. Apps are used to implement DRM, so DRM-using companies are moving to apps. To keep entertainment companies from killing the web outright, the web must have DRM too. Even if those companies don't abandon the web altogether, continues this argument, getting them to make their DRM at the W3C is better than letting them make it on an ad hoc basis. Left to their own devices, they could make DRM that made no accommodations for people with disabilities, and without the W3C's moderating influence, these companies would make DRM that would be hugely invasive of web users' privacy. The argument ends with a broad justification for DRM. Companies have to have the right to protect their copyrights. We can't expect an organization to spend fortunes creating or licensing movies and then distribute them in a way that lets anyone copy and share them.
We think that these arguments don't hold much water. The web does indeed lack some of its earlier only game in town mascot, but the reality is that companies make money by going where their companies are, and every potential customer has a browser, while only existing customers have companies' apps. The more hoops a person has to jump through in order to become your customer, the fewer customers you'll have. Netflix is in a hyper-competitive market with tons of new entrants, some for Disney, and being that streaming service you can't use in the web is a serious deficit. We also think that the media companies and tech companies would struggle to arrive at a standard for DRM outside of the W3C, even a really terrible one. We've spent a lot of time in the smoke-filled rooms of DRM standardization, and the core dynamic there is the media companies demanding full-on lockdown for every frame of video, and tech companies insisting that the best anyone can hope for is an ineffectual speed bump that they hope will mollify?
make soft.
Fuck.
The media companies. Often as not, these negotiations collapse under their own weight. What year is it?
What? 2017. Late 17.
Yeah, okay. Sounds recent.
Yeah. It's recent.
Then there's the matter of patents. Companies that think DRM is a good idea also love software patents, and the result is an impenetrable thicket of patents that make getting anything done next to impossible. The W3C's patent pooling mechanism, which is uniquely comprehensive in the standards world and stands as an example of the best way to do this sort of thing, was essential to making DRM standardization possible. What's more, there are key players in the DRM world, like Adobe, who hold significant patent portfolios but are playing an ever-dwindling role in the world of DRM. The avowed goal of EME was to kill Flash. If the companies involved had to all sit down and negotiate a new patent deal without the W3C's framework, any of these companies could turn troll and insist that all the rest would have to sell out big dollars to license their patents. They have nothing to lose by threatening the entire enterprise and everything to gain from even a minuscule per user royalty for something that will be
rolled out into 3 billion browsers. Finally, there is no indication that EME had anything to do with protecting legitimate business interests. Streaming video services like Netflix rely on customers to subscribe to a whole library with constantly added new materials and a recommendation engine to help them navigate the catalog. DRM for streaming video is all about preventing competition, not protecting copyrights. The purpose of DRM is to give companies the legal tools to prevent activities that would otherwise be allowed. The DRM part doesn't have to work in the sense of preventing copyright infringement, so long as it allows for the invocation of the DMCA. So it's a threat.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing is a threat, Scott.
Yeah,
okay. Yes. I've been video.
And just in between, it's 5 out of 4.
Yes.
I think
we have
some online people against Chrome.
Oh, we'll not finish it anyway.
Link we can.
You can stay.
Finish it as well.
Yeah.
I think we can finish the chapter and then you can see where it's going. Anyway.
Yeah, I think that's.
Stream to each other.
We are going to. So just until the control is done.
To see how true this is, just look at Widevine, Google's version of EME. Google brought the company that made Widevine in 2010, but it wasn't until 2016 that an independent researcher actually took a close look at how well it prevented videos from leaking. That researcher, David Lifshitz, found that Widevine was trivial to circumvent, and it had been since its inception that the errors that made Widevine so ineffective were obvious to even cursory examination. If the millions of dollars and the high power personnel committed to EME were allocated to create a technology that would effectively prevent copyright infringement, then you'd think that Netflix or one of the other media companies in the negotiation would have diverted some of those resources to a quick audit to make sure that the stuff actually worked as advertised. Funny story, Lipschitz is an Israeli at Ben Gurion University, and Israel happens to be a rare country that doesn't ban breaking DRM, meaning that Israelis are among the only people who can do this kind of research without fear and legal retaliation. But the biggest proof that EME was just means to shut down legitimate competitors and not an effort to protect copyright is what happened the next.
Ooh, cliffhanger.
Subscribe now.
Previously on the
in Monday readings.
Monday readings and then you can change the end acronym, you know? MM Monday reading, MDR. Previously on MDR.
Otherwise known as SDR.
Session?
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. And goodbye.